Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 87. I do hope you're all keeping well. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's truly wonderful to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast and welcome patrons who joined the Talking Tudors family in September. A very warm welcome to Horton, Espy, two lovely Annas, Olivia, and username Podmore's Mum. I'm so very thankful for your support and immense generosity. If you love the podcast and never miss an episode, perhaps you'd consider becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website on thetudortrail.com or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family, and in addition to receiving lots of Tudor-themed goodies, you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. October's prize is a set of three Tudor-themed Christmas decorations designed by artist Catherine Holman. With Christmas just around the corner, you might like to check out ColouringTudorHistory.com for a range of gifts that will delight any Tudor history lover. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about the research and history behind her excellent Tudor novels is historian and author Nicola Cornick. Nicola grew up in Yorkshire and studied history at the University of London and at Ruskin College, Oxford. She worked in academia for a number of years before becoming a full-time writer. She's the author of acclaimed dual time mysteries as well as of award-winning historical romance. When she isn't writing, Nicola volunteers as a guide and researcher for the National Trust at the 17th century hunting lodge Ashdown House. She's given talks and chaired panels for a number of festivals and conferences, including the London Book Fair and the Historical Novel Society. Nicola also gives talks on public and local history topics to history societies and other interested groups. She's a former chair of the Romantic Novelists Association and is the current RNA archivist and a trustee of the Friends of Lydiard Park. In her spare time, Nicola is a puppy walker for the Guide Dogs charity. My conversation with Nicola straight after this musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Nicola. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And thank you for inviting me today. It's lovely to talk to you.
Yes, it's so wonderful to have you on the show. So I suppose a good place to start would be by you just introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about your background.
Right. Well, my name's Nicola Cornick. I'm a writer and a historian. I suppose the history thing was what started first. I was completely immersed in history since I was a child. So it made perfect sense. I wanted to study history for as long as I could remember. I'm not sure where it came from, because nobody in my family, people weren't not interested in history, but there wasn't anybody who it was a special thing for. So it felt as though it was my special thing. So that was really nice. And I studied history first at London University, and then many years later at Ruskin College, Oxford. But I didn't actually work with history. I was working in an office in a university for the time that I had the history as an interest in the background. So I wear two hats, really, I think. One is as an author of dual time novels for HarperCollins, which focus on the stories of women from the footnotes of history, if you like, the people that we don't always hear that much about for various different reasons. But these days, my other hat is as a historian at a couple of stately homes that we have local to where I live, one of which is Ashdown House, which is post Tudor, although it has got the estate has a very interesting Tudor history, and also Lydiard. Again, the house is 18th century, but the history goes back so much further, and so many amazing stories from the Tudor period, which I'm only just starting to explore at Lydiard, so that's really exciting for me. So those are the two things that I kind of do in parallel these days: the writing historical novels and the actual sort of non-fiction history as well alongside that.
How wonderful to work at those incredible properties. You're very lucky, definitely very lucky. And so in terms of Tudor history, what sparked your interest in that period?
Well, that was two things, really. Firstly, my grandmother. I mean, having said that there wasn't anybody in the family who was particularly into history, she was very interested in historical fiction. So when I was quite young, I mean, I must have been, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7, I discovered her secret stash of historical fiction novels in the wardrobe in the spare room at her house. I've speculated often why she felt she had to hide them away, but I didn't mind. So I rummaged through all the clothes, and there at the back of the wardrobe were all her novels, and there was Jean Plaidy, and it was like a treasure trove, really. So I found my way into reading Tudor history through those novels, Margaret Campbell Barnes, Jean Plaidy, all of those sort of that vintage of books, and it was just amazing. I loved it. And she was so interested for all of her life in Tudor history. So we would read things together as I got older. And then later on, when I was an adult, she was still reading Tudor set books and would ring me up and say, I read this and I'm not sure if it's true, and can you tell me what you think? And it was just wonderful. We had a wonderful relationship like that. And the other inspiration, I think, was my history teacher at school, my very first history teacher. The second one almost killed history for me, but the first one was inspirational. She taught history as though it was a story. And I can still vividly remember the way she told us about Henry VIII and, of course, wives. I mean, that was so gripping for all of us. I was at an all-girls school, and it was kind of like a boarding school type feeling. We were all sitting around the teacher, and she was telling us about Anne Boleyn, and we were all kind of gripped by this story. So again, I think these things make such an impression on you when you're that age, and that really sparks the interest. And then I think that just stays with you if you're lucky, and it did for me.
Yes, you got caught in the Tudor web like so many of us. It's difficult to escape.
Early. Isn't it?
Yes, very early. Now, you've mentioned that you have those parallel sort of roles that you take on, and that you're a writer, and you've written some fantastic novels, including one called The Forgotten Sister, which is inspired by one of the greatest, I think, historical mysteries around the death of Amy Robsart, which was the wife of Robert Dudley. So what drew you to this particular Tudor mystery?
I think, well, for a start, historical mysteries, whenever they're set, kind of really fascinate me, because it's that element of not knowing. We're never going to know unless you find some definitive piece of evidence, which seems unlikely, but, you know, it's always possible. So there's something about exploring a mystery that just really interests me, and coming up with your own version of what might have happened. I think probably academic historians would disapprove of people like me, because I love the speculation, the gaps in history that you can fill with your own theories of what might have happened. So a historical mystery gives you perfect opportunity to do that. And Amy's story, of course, is one of the biggest historical mysteries that there is. the idea of how did she die? Was it an accident? Or was she murdered? You know, and we don't know. And so there's plenty of room in there to explore. It's one of the stories I'd always wanted to write. So it was terribly exciting to be able to sort of to research and write that book.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about what you learnt about Amy during your research, because of course she's so often eclipsed by her much more famous husband, Robert Dudley, and by his relationship with the Queen, of course, Queen Elizabeth. So can you tell us a little bit about the woman that you met during your research?
Yes, exactly as you've said. As I am drawn to sort of the women who are in the shadows of history, really, Amy was a perfect example of that. You so seldom get a feel for her as a person, as opposed to the third person in that triangle. And actually, the more I found out about Amy, the more that really started to annoy me, that she was totally eclipsed, because they are such huge characters, both Elizabeth and Robert Dudley, and they've been made into such huge characters. So Amy was very much in the background. But actually, I mean, it's difficult. There's not that many sources that you can draw on directly. You have to infer quite a lot about her. But once you start looking for clues to Amy, she comes across as actually a really interesting person, particularly her early life, which I think we don't hear very much about, before she got married. I mean, she was 18 when she got married. But I suppose the other thing I would say is, where we do have evidence of Amy, it's kind of nearly always through the eyes of men. And so what's written about her almost always relates to her beauty. For example, the imperial ambassador, I think in 1559, referred to her as a beautiful wife, but you don't get a feel for her personally. So I tried to go back to her early life to start with. So we know that she came from a gentry family who grew up in Norfolk, which is actually quite significant in itself, because East Anglia in the Tudor period was thought of as a wild and lawless place. It wasn't very, you know, people didn't think of it as being particularly civilised. And of course, there was some civil unrest there that her family was involved in with Kett's Rebellion. So she would have been very aware of the political climate of the time, and also the religious difficulties. And because she'd actually, as a girl, we know, for example, and we know she was educated, she wrote a fine hand, that was described in her letters, but also that she spent time in the household of the Duchess of Norfolk, Kenninghall. So she would also have had sort of that training as a lady in waiting in a grand household. But of course, they were strong Catholics theme there. So she was aware of all the political and religious undercurrents, I think, in society and in her life at that time. So she's actually got quite a rich background, I think, in terms of her growing up. Sometimes she's portrayed as this sort of simple country girl who Robert Dudley took a fancy to, but I think she's very far from that. And the other thing that struck me about her, which I think was really interesting, is her commercial savvy, if you like, because when she inherited the estates of both her parents, in fact, her mother brought quite a substantial amount of land to her marriage to Amy's father. So the two estates together had quite a rich wool trade going on there. And Amy is perfectly conversant with that. We know from her letters to when Robert, I mean, obviously it went to Robert when she inherited and as they were married, but he actually kind of let her get on with that some of the time, probably to give her something to do while he was at court. And so she's the one writing to the steward in Norfolk and talking about the yield of wool and the weight and the cost and all of these things. So, you know, she's got all of that. She's got all of that sort of background to her, which again, I mean, so seldom comes out. And on the other side of the coin, you know, her servants speak of her piety, her generosity and her sweetness of nature. So you can start to get around a more rounded picture of the sort of woman she is. I think particularly it's harder later when she's so constrained in the places where she lives and her life so isolated, and that must have been very difficult. I'd like to know so much more about her, and I'm kind of still sort of working on. This is the trouble, actually, with all these books. It's the same with the Phantom Tree. As soon as you discover all these interesting things, you don't want to stop when you finish the book. You want to carry on finding out. So, you know, I'm kind of still reading up and researching about Amy, because I'm desperate to find out more about her person behind the story, if you like.
Well, it does sound like she was, like so many women at the time, very resourceful as well, which I always admire about these women, and I draw inspiration from them myself as well.
Yeah,
Nicola,
absolutely.
I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, Nicola. I want to ask, in your opinion, and I know this is a very complicated issue, and there really probably isn't one answer, as you've said, but in your opinion, what does your gut feeling say in the research you've done? Did Amy fall or was she pushed?
I kind of go between one or the other on this, but I think if I had to absolutely come down on one, I would say I think she fell, because having really studied what happened, and I mean, I spent so long musing on this, I think it was an accident, because although I must admit I came out of my research disliking Robert Dudley intensely, I don't think he was a stupid man, though.
No.
And I think he even, I mean, we see things so differently, of course, with hindsight, but I think even he at the time surely would have realised how damaging it could be to his reputation if he was seen in any way to be connected with something like that. Because we see the proof of that in what happened. You know, his enemies are just waiting. There's so many people who strongly dislike him, even so early on, particularly, I guess, so early on because of the close connection to Elizabeth and the jealousy there. So, you know, people are waiting for him to make a false move, and it's a complete gift to somebody if he can be tied in any way to that. And you kind of see that in the way that he is so determined that the inquest is going to exonerate him totally by implication. You know, it was an accident, therefore he can't have anything to do with it. Because I think that's all about him and about his reputation and his future prospects with Elizabeth. I mean, one of the reasons I didn't like him was because there is no word of distress or concern about poor old Amy, who's dead. It's just all about him, really. But I think I don't think that he had anything to do with it. Something I have considered, and I know other people have talked about this, is whether it was a bit of a Thomas Becket situation, and so maybe some of his retainers thought, oh, we could do Robert a bit of a favor here by getting rid of his wife, and maybe he didn't know about that. And you know, these things did happen, that they were a rough bunch, some of the men who worked for him. And you know, I find that completely plausible, that they might have thought that they were actually doing something helpful. And maybe, you know, I don't think he was complicit in that, but I could see how that could have happened. And then, of course, it creates enormous problems for him afterwards. So yes, either of those two options. Regretfully, I can't pin that one on Robert, I don't feel, because as I say, I mean, I think he's a fascinating character and a really interesting man, and actually I wouldn't mind having the chance to sit down and talk to him, but I don't think he was a particularly pleasant person in that respect. But I don't think he was a murderer. Not her anyway.
And Nicola, can you clarify something? Because obviously sometimes in popular depictions, she's depicted as being like very unwell, very sick, suffering from something. Was there any evidence to suggest that she was already dying of something?
Well, there was rumour, but I don't know. I didn't find anything, again, anything definite. You know, there's no references to doctors being called or to anything, anyone else, other than as part of this great big surge of rumour and speculation at the court about Robert and Elizabeth, and oh well, you know, his wife's dying, so it's only a matter of time kind of thing. And in fact, there is a very telling point made. I think it's in the book about Death and the Virgin, which talks about the sort of the triangle between Robert and Elizabeth and Amy and her death. But a telling evidence there about how she's ordering new clothes and you know, sort of having what would appear to be a perfectly normal time in the society in limited as it was in Cumnor at the time, and no indication there's anything wrong at all, just a month before her death. So that doesn't suggest somebody who's kind of withdrawn into themselves, or who's feeling ill, or anything like that. So I wasn't convinced that was actually the case. Again, I think, you know, I'd really very much like to find out more about that. But no, I mean, I couldn't discover anything more than circumstantial in the chat about the time. And I mean, there was so much of that going on. All
Oh,
these
so
different sort
fascinating. I know.
of
Oh, goodness. Okay, well, we could keep talking about that, but I'm just going to change it
Yes,
up a little bit.
absolutely.
Now, I did read that when you're researching your novels, you enjoy to visit places connected to the locations in your story, which I think is fabulous. So could you tell us about some of the most memorable visits you've made while writing Amy's story?
I mean, I do absolutely love, I always make a point of going to as many of the locations associated with my books as I can, because I feel you can get such a sense of place and of the people, the connection to them from just being there. In Amy's case, it was really rather sad, I have to be honest. It wasn't helped by the fact that the day I went to Cumnor was awful weather. It was absolutely pouring with rain and it was a howling wind. So I stood in the graveyard next to where Cumnor Place had been when the house was still standing. And it was very grim and I felt miserable, and I thought, I can only imagine how Amy must have felt in a place like this. So it wasn't difficult there to kind of connect to her sense of isolation and loneliness being somewhere like that. Particularly as well, one of the funny things I did discover was in the church at Cumnor, there's a life-size statue of Queen Elizabeth I, which kind of feels a bit tactless, really.
Wow, I didn't know that. I'm going to have to try and Google some images.
Yes, so that was, and the story is that Robert Dudley actually put it there, and I thought, really, this is just piling it on, isn't it? But so that was sad, and I also felt sad when I went to the church where she was originally, well, where she was buried, because of course they've lost her tomb. And so you stand there, and this is a bit of a theme actually. I was thinking that when I was thinking about talking to you and lost people, they know she was buried there, there's a record of that, but at some point she was sort of tidied away in the crypt, and so now all you get is a little plaque saying somewhere around here Amy Robsart was buried. And I just found that very telling and very poignant, because it felt like a summary of Amy's story in a way, as far as Robert and Elizabeth were concerned. You know, tidy her away, forget about her, and she's gone. And that was what made me even more determined, you know, we're not going to forget Amy. She was a person in her own right and a really interesting person. So, you know, we want to get these stories of these women out there. I mean, and it is usually women, and make sure that they're not forgotten, because it just felt really quite sad. But having said that, I wouldn't have missed going to any of these places just for the opportunity to kind of connect with those people who've been there, you know, centuries ago. It's an extraordinary feeling, isn't it, visiting really significant sites, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I love it. I love nothing more than walking in the footsteps of people from the past. Yeah. And standing and imagining. And like you say, even when there's nothing left, you know, you can still get a sort of sense and feel for the location, and it's great. I absolutely love it.
Absolutely.
Now, Nicola, I want to talk about one of your other novels now, called The Phantom Tree. And that tells another very intriguing story, the one of Mary Seymour, which was the daughter of Catherine Parr and Thomas Seymour. I'm sure lots of our listeners have heard about her. But tragically, Mary disappears from the sources at a very young age. So what do we know of little Mary's life, and when does she make her final appearance in the records?
Yes, well, Mary, I remember when I first came across Mary, was in a book by Jean Plaidy. And I didn't even know that Catherine Parr and Thomas Seymour at that point, I didn't know that they'd had a child, because you just never really heard anything about her. So that was a story I wanted to write for about 20 years. So what we do know about Mary is she was born in on the 30th of August 1548, and of course her mother Catherine Parr died very shortly afterwards. One thing I found out when I was researching that book, which I hadn't known previously or read about previously, was it was actually her grandmother Marjorie Seymour, who came from Wiltshire up to Sudeley Castle, which was where Mary had been born, to look after her in the immediate aftermath of Catherine's death. But again, there's a bit of a theme with poor old Mary being shunted around like a parcel from one person to another. For whatever reason, she didn't go back to Wolf Hall, to the Seymours' side of the family there. And of course it was less than a year later that her father was executed in 1549. So Thomas Seymour, well, that's a whole nother story.
We won't
get into that one. But so poor old Mary, she's less than a year old, and at this point she's shunted off to a close friend of her mother's, Catherine, Duchess of Suffolk. Now, that was Thomas's expressed wish, that Mary should go and live with at Grimsthorpe with the Duchess. And that was interesting, I think, because Catherine never really gave the impression that she was particularly keen to have little Mary. So there's a record of Mary being sent off with a huge retinue of 40 servants, including about ten nursemaids, rockers for her cradle, milkmaids to milk the two cows that they sent with us. So, I mean, there's a great long list of her sort of huge retinue. So I can see from Catherine's point of view, this is going to be difficult, you know, to incorporate into your own household. This is a really high-born child and a very expensive baby to support, basically. And so from here on in, we only have written records relating to this in relation to how expensive Mary is, basically, and what a, she's a bit of a nuisance, which is terribly, terribly sad. So Catherine writes on more than one occasion to William Cecil, please, can I have some more money? Can you do something? Can you talk to the council? Because they're supposed to have sent more, you know, more of Catherine's and therefore Mary's possessions. But of course, the whole thing going on in the background was everything was because Thomas had been executed for treason. So everything had been taken away. Mary wasn't an heiress anymore. She had nothing. So there was all this stuff going on in the background that just took forever. And meanwhile, Catherine, the Duchess of Suffolk, was saying, I basically cannot afford to support this baby. And even more sad, you know, she spoke to Mary's uncle, William Parr, the Marquess of Northampton. He didn't want her either. He wasn't interested. He was too busy with all his marital complications. So nobody wanted her. And it was tragic, really. And in fact, the last record that we have of Mary, official record of her, is in 1550, when it was sort of like the last plea for money. And Cecil said, yes, OK, you know, I'm on the case. He did actually apply for more money for Mary's upkeep. But then the record goes completely silent. There's nothing. The money was never paid. But equally, there's nothing about Mary's death. And that's very puzzling, of course, because if a child of that sort of status had died, you would expect there to be at least some account of it somewhere. There's no grave. And of course, again, in the space where there's this lack of evidence, lots of rumours and stories have grown up about where and when she might have died. Even, you know, in Agnes Strickland's book, she lives to a ripe old age, gets married and has lots of descendants. So, you know, there's plenty of speculation about what happened to Mary, but not a single shred of evidence to say definitely what her fate was. So yes, again, it's a gift for a writer, though, isn't it? It's a gift for a novelist to fill those gaps in the historical record.
It's just heartbreaking, isn't it? Just thinking about Catherine Parr, her life, and how she finally, you know, had the man she loved, the baby she wanted, and then it all just disappears within such a short period.
Yes.
So was Mary, was that at Grimsthorpe, was that the last sort of location that she was known to have been at?
We know that she went to Grimsthorpe, which was where Catherine was living at the time that Mary, so there's the record of all these people, all these servants traipsing over there with the cows and everything, and the fact that they then tried to accommodate her within the castle there and so on. But yes, so I mean, you would imagine that if she had died as a child, she would have been buried in the church there's no record of that at all. Catherine's former chaplain did write an epitaph that sounded as though it was meant for Mary, but unfortunately he doesn't name her in it, and nor does it refer to where she might be buried. So it's a tantalizing clue that it may be about Mary, and that she did die as a child, but again, we can't pin it down to a specific time, date, location or anything. So again, it's another of these sort of little hints that are in the mix. When I get the chance, I'd love to go over to Grimsthorpe and sort of poke around in the church records there. I'm sure many people have already done that, but you're kind of always looking for clues, I guess, and hoping that you're going to find that one bit of evidence that's not previously been discovered, or in the family papers or something that just says this is what happened to Mary Seymour. On the other hand, it's nicer to think that maybe she didn't die at the age of two, and that, you know, she might have had that long and happy life that Agnes Strickland imagined for her.
Yeah, that would be lovely. Poor Mary. I'd love to know as well. And yeah, you never know with the church records, because sometimes I think people assume, oh, somebody would have had a look, so you never know. I think we should do it now. Nicola, so your books always include some pretty fabulous houses. For example, Wolf Hall is the setting of The Phantom Tree. So I know that you were able to explore the grounds as part of your research. So what was it like? What do we know of it its appearance, its layout in the 16th century, and what's left for us to see today?
I still can't talk about Wolf Hall without being totally overexcited, because it was one of the most amazing historical experiences of my life going there. I think, I mean, not only was I able to explore the grounds and see the archaeological excavations that they have going on there to find the foundations of the Tudor Hall, but I also did get a private tour of the existing house, which does also incorporate some of the Tudor building, which previously people hadn't realised. And of course, I also got to go down the sewers, which is,
oh, yes.
I mean, the height of the depths to which I will go for my research, going down the sewers with a descendant of the Seymour family. You know, you can't get better than that, really. I mean, it was just completely amazing. What I found really astonishing, of course, was the fact that everybody for so long thought that Wolf Hall had been completely demolished. Yeah. And yet there in plain sight was a house with part of it still dating back to the Tudor time. So the kitchens particularly have got a lot of Tudor features still left in them. So I stood in there thinking, oh, Jane Seymour might have been here, but then I thought, well, probably not in the kitchens.
Yeah,
but right. You know, that kind of feeling. So that western part of the existing house, I think there's still quite a lot of Tudor there. The rest of it, apart from the sewers, which are an amazing example of one of the finest examples of 16th century sewer systems, most of the rest of the, what was a huge house really, almost a palace, has gone. But luckily you can trace where it was in the, by following the sewer system, obviously underground, because it leads you where the buildings would have been above it, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
And of course, then they're then tying that into the archaeology above ground. So they've discovered a couple of towers and the gatehouse, and they're able, and using that evidence plus maps and descriptions, of course, they'd like. But yes, I mean, just standing there in the gardens and sort of seeing where the old formal gardens and all the different, because again they've got the, you know, the old ladies' garden and the young ladies' garden,
yeah,
described in the Tudor period. You know, wonder what point you had to move over from one garden to the next. So you can see where that was on the ground. I mean, it's just really is an astonishing place to visit. As I say, I think one of the, I mean, I've been so fortunate and gone to some amazing places, but that has to be the highlight. I think it's going to be hard to beat that one.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think always a good indication of the sizes of the house is how long the royal party during their progress has stayed. So they, so when Anne and Henry,
yes,
were there, they stayed for a week in 1535. So I think, wow, it must have been a very substantial house, definitely. Now, Nicola, your novels often include elements of the paranormal. So why do you weave this into your stories?
That is a really interesting question, because it feels right and the thing that I want to do, but I've very seldom actually thought, why am I doing this? And I think I am very drawn to the paranormal as a person and to sort of gothic-y things. I think I also grew up reading those sorts of books alongside historical fiction. So Mary Stuart, for example, the sort of the gothic-y elements in her writing, and Barbara Erskine and Time Slip sort of books. But I think it helps, kind of, for me anyway, it enhances that connection to the past, and it's another way of exploring. It's a quite kind of an immediate way. If you've got a time slip, for example, and somebody sees visions or travels back or whatever it is, that just helps, that gives you that extra dimension of exploring the past. But I think in the end it probably just comes down to the fact I'm fascinated by the paranormal, and I love exploring the different elements of that. When I'm writing the books, it feels a natural fit, really.
Well, I'm fascinated by the same. I'm just like you. And whenever I see that a story has a time slip in it, I want to read it. I'm the kind of person that goes to places like Hampton Court or wherever and says, please, can I have a time slip? Hasn't yet, but I'll keep trying.
Yes, maybe one day, you never
Fingers
know.
Fingers crossed. Apparently the weather has to be stormy, things have to be, so I have to get all the right elements for, yes, my time slip to occur. Now, I'd love, just keeping on that theme a little bit, I'd love to hear about some of the ghost stories associated with Lidlcote House that you uncovered during your research.
Yes, Lidlcote's supposed to be, I think, I mean, a lot of places say this, but it is meant to be one of the most haunted houses in England, along with so many others. We're very lucky, of course, because you can actually go and visit and you can stay at Lidlcote if you're brave enough. I'm not sure that I'd want to, because I would say it's a place with a very, very odd atmosphere. So although I didn't see any ghosts while I was there, I can well believe the stories. And of course, the main story about Lidlcote is around Wild William Darrell, who is a character in The Phantom Tree, who was a thoroughly bad lot, and he was supposedly responsible for the murdering a child by throwing it onto the fire, a ghastly story, in one of the rooms in Lidlcote House. A lot of people have said that when they've been visiting or staying there, they hear the crying of a baby in the haunted bedroom in Lidlcote. Yeah, it's fairly grim, really. And again, various other stories of ghosts that haunt the house and the grounds. As I say, I haven't actually experienced that myself at Lidlcote, but there is a very strong atmosphere in that particular bedroom. I didn't want to linger there, and it's very, very, very powerful. It sort of feels as though the misery of the place has kind of seeped into the walls there. So I can easily believe that, and I have spoken to people who have said that they've seen and heard things at Lidlcote House. I think there's also meant to be a ghost of, I mean, Anne Boleyn gets associated with so many places, doesn't she? But I think I read that there's a ghostly carriage that she's riding in that gallops up the drive as well. So you could certainly have a very, very spooky experience.
It's quite an eventful night there.
You would not get a moment's sleep.
No, you'd be exhausted. Well, I know that Anne's carriage, well, The story of the carriage also is associated with Blickling Hall in Norfolk. So apparently a similar thing occurs there. So she's very busy. Anne's ghost is out and about.
One end of the country to the other.
Well, that's fabulous. I do love a good ghost story, that's for sure. Nicola, you've obviously spent many, you know, many, many years researching the Tudor court and Tudor history. So during all this time, have you ever discovered anything that maybe particularly surprised you or intrigued you, something you had no idea about or anything like that that's quite memorable?
I mean, I'm always discovering things that I had no idea about. I mean, I think it's really, and that's one of the pleasures of reading and researching the period, isn't it? That no matter how much time you spend in that, there's always something new that you come across, and it's fascinating. I mean, I'm actually at the moment I'm writing another Tudor set novel. It finishes with the gunpowder plot, so just into the Stuart era. But I'm looking at all of the roots of the gunpowder plot in the Tudor period, and that I find absolutely fascinating. How far back you can, you know, how you see all these elements coming together. And one of the things that completely intrigued me, which I didn't know about, but I do now, is because this book has got elements of not the Knights Templar, but the Knights Hospitaller in it. Nice. And I had no idea that was still continuing in England in the Tudor era. And of course, again, a very complicated history because of the changes in religion and the changes of ruler. So at the moment, I'm hot on the trail of the treasure of the Knights Hospitallers from the Tudor period. So that is absolutely fascinating me. So that's what I'm researching at the moment. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, none of us are ever going to stop, are we? Because we're all so, it's just so you're always discovering something else. One thing that I am interested in, and again, obviously this comes out a lot, I think, in every single book to do with the Tudors that I write, is how easily people were lost. And we've talked about this, you know, about losing Mary, about losing Amy Robsart's tomb, about Catherine Parr herself. I had no idea when I was researching the Phantom Tree that her tomb was lost for centuries. They're very careless. It's kind of, it feels as though, and again, you don't necessarily want to say, well, it's just because they were women, because after all, Richard III was lost for centuries. But there's very, very, it's very interesting. There's something there I want to tease out about this idea of when you're gone and are you forgotten? I don't think it's probably not specific to the Tudor era, but it's something that comes out a lot when I'm studying Tudor women. So that interests me because, again, in the Gunpowder Plot book, I'm writing about Catherine Catesby, Robert Catesby's wife, another woman who, you know, she was incredibly significant in part of that story, and yet you never hear about that. So, yeah. Yes, sorry. So that's kind of
that's kind of good. Yeah, and the man that pops to mind that also is another one where we don't, you know, is Cardinal Wolsey. Of course, we know the general area, but where exactly? No, and Mary Boleyn, another one. We don't know anything about Mary Boleyn. That's there's just all conjecture, and that's another one I'd love to find, Nicola. Mary Boleyn.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazing?
Where is she buried?
Yes, there's so much work to be done.
There's a lot of work. So there is always new things to be found and learned, which is so amazing. Now, Nicola, at the end of the episodes of Talking Tudors, we like to play a little game of 10 to go. So these are just 10 questions just to get to know you a little bit better.
Okay.
So the first question, very easy. Favourite period film or show?
Oh, gosh. Well, you say that's easy, but actually it's not, is it? Because there are
Let's make it one of your favourites.
Oh, dear, that's a really, really tricky one. And I don't think my favourite's Tudor. That's terrible,
okay.
Isn't it?
That's all right. We'll forgive you. Don't worry.
No, one of my favourite period films is actually called The Abduction Club. Oh. And I don't know if you've ever come across that. It's based on a true story set in Ireland in the 18th century. And it's all about the, it's quite a romp, but it's a lot of fun. And it's based on the concept that when the eldest son and the younger sons have nothing, one of the things that they used to do in Ireland was abduct an heiress to make their fortunes, really. Yes, very... When you put it like that, it doesn't sound particularly fun, actually. But the story is quite interesting because it's got two friends who decide to take this way out of their financial difficulties with somewhat mixed results. And it's a clever story. It's funny and it's romantic, but it's also got a big adventure element in it. So yes, I watch and rewatch that, and I always enjoy that. But it's not a film that people know very much about.
That sounds like fun. I've written it down so I can have a look if I can find it. So do you have a bucket list, Nicola? What's an item?
Yes,
what's
I kind
an
of
item
have a list
that would
of
be
things.
On there?
Mostly, I have a travel bucket list, actually. Yes. So, because although I've been to some astonishing places, there's still so many places that I want to go to. Nearly all of them have got some kind of historical connection, because unbelievably, there's loads of historical places that I've never been to, or Brighton. Brighton Pavilion is one of them. I mean, you know, I wrote Regency books for years and years, and yet I've never been to the Regency Pavilion in Brighton and things like that. So they're all relatively modest things, I think, that I could probably achieve, or at least I hope to, when we're allowed out again.
And that would be lovely.
It's funny, isn't it? I think at the moment things are quite influenced by the situation that we're in. So for me at the moment, actually, at the top of my bucket list is going to all the places that I'm currently writing about, and I can't at the moment. And so actually that will be amazing when I can visit Chastleton House, which is where Robert and Catherine Catesby lived when they first got married. When I can do that will be right at the top of my list.
Yeah, you can give that one a big tick. And Nicola, what's a new skill that you'd like to learn?
Yes, I think I'd like to be able to play a historic instrument.
Yeah.
I rediscovered my childhood zither the other day when I was tidying out the cupboards, and I sat down and played a few little notes, and I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a lute?
Yes.
Or something like that, because I've always been quite musical. I sing, but I've never really developed a really good skill with a musical instrument. And I think if I was going to do that, I think it would be much more fun for it to be something that you could then imagine people playing hundreds of years ago. That would feel good.
Yeah, that would be lovely. I'd love to learn all the sort of skills that the Tudor women had. That would be really fun, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, yeah.
Now, what is a book that you've read more than once?
Yes, again, so many, really. I've got quite a heaving keeper shelf of, a book. I've actually got Fernie by James Long. Now, that's about reincarnation, and that is an amazing, amazing book.
Okay,
it it sort of takes a character through centuries in their different incarnations. And I could not, you know, when people often say, I couldn't put that book down. I literally didn't put that book down. Yeah. I carried it with me when I went out. I was sort of waiting in the car park somewhere. I'd whip it out of my bag to read it because I couldn't stop reading it. And at the end, I felt, I don't know, again, you know, people say, oh, I had a book hangover or whatever when I finished it. I felt so bereft at the end of that book. It's an extraordinary book. And even better, there's a sequel to it now.
Oh, so. Fantastic. I've, again, never heard of it. So that's...
No, he's definitely look for that. He writes kind of dual time, and but not very many books. So you have to kind of hunt them down. But when apparently when Fernie came out originally, because it's not it's quite an old book, it did cause a sensation. It was a bit like Barbara Erskine's Lady of Hay, but I missed that completely at the time, and I'm just so glad that I was able to pick that up sort of later. So yes, if you like paranormal
all
stuff,
right, great,
and you like the reincarnation theme, it's really
fantastic.
Good.
Now, Nicola, do you have any writing rituals?
No, I'm one of those authors who I don't really go in for that. In fact, if I could just have some writing discipline, that would be a step forward. I think the only thing I would say is that I write better when I have the dog in the room with me. He curls
up.
There's something about the atmosphere and the kind of soothing nature of his presence, because he's a very calm 9-year-old Labrador now. So he curls up at my feet, and then I just feel in the right space for that. So I can write when he's not there, but it's not the same. So
that's so sweet. I haven't heard that one before. So that's
a bit like my talisman.
Oh, that's lovely. Now, this, because of what we've been discussing with the paranormal theme, do you believe in past lives or maybe simultaneous lives?
I think I could cope with no, I know what you mean. Simultaneous lives, that's an interesting one. I definitely believe in past lives, definitely. I would even go so far as to say that I once had a past life experience. So and I feel a definite affinity with certain time periods and places, which I think is connected to that. I've never explored it kind of with past life regression or anything like that, but I'm happy, comfortable for it to be there. So yes, I absolutely believe in that. I love the idea of simultaneous life.
Yes.
It's quite complicated, isn't it?
It is, and it's hard for our sort of with our brain the way it is to kind of understand it. But I quite like that idea too. I think
that would
explain a lot of why some of us feel so drawn to certain periods, and why, you know, 500 years ago seems so present to us that enjoy that period. And so it's something to explore.
I'm totally with you now.
Something to explore, yes. Now, Nicola, if you could bring an item from the past, anything, it can be anything, into the future, what would you pick? Just something from history.
Oh, it's dangerous, isn't it?
It is.
Never know what you might spark. Oh, I think probably because of my interest. I mean, I've got quite an interest in art history. I don't know anything about it other than, you know, I've never studied it. But I would love to have been in the studio of an artist when they were painting somebody like Elizabeth I and grab the canvas halfway through and bring it into the present. So you actually saw that you were able to say, you know, that painting. Well, I mean, the trouble with that is then you wouldn't have the finished version, would you?
Yeah, well, that's the problem.
Yeah, this is what I mean. It makes life so much more complicated. I just would love the idea of a kind of having something like that. Because, you know, I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here, but you know these paintings when they analyse them and there's actually someone else underneath the picture. That would be so you might be there when they're just going to paint over somebody and
then you snatch it.
Yeah, quickly take it away, because and then you've got that portrait of someone and I just think that would be amazing. You kind of possess something, just anything really. The idea of possessing something, I mean, I guess that's probably why I inherited a little miniature a few months ago from family heirloom. And I'm completely fascinated with it. And I'm sure that's why we like things like that, because it is essentially that, something from the past, yes, from years ago, that you've got sitting here in front of you. It would be amazing. But, I could come up with such a list of things I'd go back and grab if I had the chance. As long as I was guaranteed I could come back into the present.
Well, that's the thing, exactly, that we need that guarantee travel, first. Now, Nicola, do you have a signature recipe?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes.
You have.
Well, luckily for this time of year, actually. Well, it's apple crumble.
Oh, yum.
My own personal apple crumble recipe, where there is, I have to say, a higher proportion of crumble than apple.
Well, that's good, because that's the best part, isn't it?
And obviously it's good for you because it's got fruit in it, also mixed with blackberries, which obviously picked from our hedgerows around here, and a bit of cinnamon mixed in, and then this lovely crumbly topping. Yes, I remember once some friends came to tea and he said something like, oh, that's the best apple crumble I've ever tasted. And I don't think his wife spoke to him for quite a while afterwards. I gathered I sort of caused a bit of a problem there. She never made apple crumble again.
No,
it feels lovely and indulgent, especially, as I say, this time of year. It's perfect, really.
Yeah, that's lovely. And I find that those kinds of recipes really connect you to the past as well. When I make an apple crumble or something like that, I feel so connected to women, to my grandparents, yes, and ancestors. And yeah,
absolutely. When you think of like we were saying, all those Tudor housewives with their distilling and their pickling and stuff. Imagine them out in the orchards picking their fruit and then coming in and making a fabulous recipe. So yes, I mean, we're just doing such traditional things, aren't we?
Now, Nicola, this is Lucky Last, and it's a little bit of a word association one for you. So the first word that comes to mind when I say Henry VIII.
Actually, I think the first word maybe I'll discard the first word that came to mind and go for the second one, which was yeah, well, the first word I thought was psychopath, actually.
Yeah,
well, but,
yeah, understand. But
that's a bit simplistic. Henry VIII, well, obviously it had to be, actually it was Anne of Cleves, because she is the most interesting to me of his wives at the moment. She's the one I want to know more about, because she just feels a bit more of a cipher than some of the others. So
Anne of Cleves, lovely. Yeah, she was a fascinating woman. And the very last thing, sorry, I said that was the last question, but we've got one more thing, and it's the Tudor takeaway. So I always ask my guests for a little something for our listeners to go and read or listen or watch after the episode. So do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
I do, yes. When I was researching The Forgotten Sister, because Cumnor Hall had been destroyed, I was looking for similar buildings and places that I could study. And I came across something on the Bodleian website, actually, the University of Oxford Bodleian Museum Library website, which is called Rediscovering Rycote. And what it is, it's the history of a lost Tudor mansion. So they have recreated virtually Rycote Park in Oxfordshire, which was one of the grandest Tudor houses in the county. Both Henry VIII and Elizabeth visited there, and you can go and see it. I'm just trying to find the link now, having said that.
That's all right. I'm sure I'll find it if I do a little so little
yes
googling.
It's part of the Bodleian, okay, the Bodleian website. I did print it off specially, sorry about that.
That's all right.
And Rediscovering Rycote. So they've recreated the building. There are interviews with the people who lived there, in the imaginary characters from the Tudor period. It's really clever, but it also gives you so much information about everything, really, from the architecture to the jobs that people would do and the royal progresses. It's a really, really interesting site.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Thank you so much. And it sounds right up my alley for the things that I enjoy. So I will find that and add a link to our show notes for everyone listening, so it'll be nice and easy to find. Nicola, thank you so much for taking the time to talk Tudors. It has been a lot of fun, and I look forward to hearing more about your new book.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetutortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tutors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other tutor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is @OnTheTutorTrail and on Instagram as TheMostHappy78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking tutors with you again very soon.